Hello, this is Dan Le Batard, and we have been remiss in South Beach Sessions in bringing you the side of another gender in sports. We've done only Jemele Hill on South Beach Sessions and Danica Patrick, and so I wanted to bring you someone who is unbelievable at basketball. She is part of the most dominant American patriotic Olympic thing that we have. Breonna Stewart is excellent at what she does, and despite that excellence, it can still be a struggle to make a living in the United States, which is why she has had to go play in China and other places, because America doesn't value the dominance of women in sports the way other countries do. So we're going to talk to Breonna a little bit here, and then afterward, we're going to talk to Sarah Spain as well, because she's got some real expertise about the struggles that women face in sports, as they are really excellent and yet still have trouble drumming up value the way that Americans do the currency. Let's talk to Breonna Stewart. We're pumped about this around here, to have Breonna Stewart on South Beach Sessions with us, because there's nothing in sports better than a little patriotism, wrapping the things that you care about. And the United States kicks everybody's ass all over the world more than anything, basically, is in basketball. I don't think, like, do you have a rivalry, Breonna, with the soccer team? Because you guys are more patriotically excellent than they are, right?
I wouldn't say it's a rivalry, but we definitely support each other a lot.
Well, what are the similarities? What are the, when you say support each other a lot, because to arrive where you guys have, the path is so much different than it is for men, Breonna. Like, it is so much different. So there has to be a kinship between you guys at the top of the food chain in those sports.
Yeah, I mean, I think you just see the way we prepare ourselves, how we represent ourselves, and, you know, going and doing what we need to do when it comes time to win gold medals. And, you know, we're going for our seventh Olympic gold, which is insane when you think about it like that. But it's about making sure that every time we step on the court, no matter if the people change a little bit, that as a team we're ready to dominate.
Can you explain to us sort of what it feels like to you emotionally just to wear the uniform for the United States?
Yeah, I mean, it's a feeling that's really hard to describe, but, you know, when you're in a FIBA setting and you step on the court and you look down and you have USA written across your chest, it's something that you dream of. And, you know, I remember when I was a kid, my biggest goal was always to play in the Olympics to win a gold medal, because for me, I can't imagine anything better than playing the sport I love and representing it at the highest level possible.
You had a relationship, right? You had an intimate personal relationship with Kobe Bryant. It wasn't just motivated from afar, right?
Yeah. Him and I, we had a relationship for sure.
What happened here, and I'm sorry to make it news of the day on you, because I really do want to talk to you about who you are, how you are, and the things that that shaped you. But I am stunned, Breonna, as I look across sports. It's not just football. It's, you know, Tiger Woods. It's Djokovic at the Australian Open being mentored and just crushed by this. And I'm curious what the last few days have felt like for you.
The last few days have definitely been very tough. I think, obviously, the news of Kobe's passing and Gigi and those other seven victims was a shock to the entire world. And I think when the news broke and when I saw it, you know, I didn't want to believe it. Because I'm like, this doesn't make sense. Like, there's no way this could have happened. And then when it was confirmed and that type of thing, it was tough, you know. And it was tough for a number of reasons. It was tough because we're with USA Basketball right now, and Kobe is someone that is such a big supporter of women's basketball, and he's had a relationship with every single person on this team. And it's still hard to come to terms with, really. But we had a game the next day. We played at UConn, which Kobe and Gigi were avid UConn supporters, and it was an emotional night, but at the end of the day, we knew that we had to get on the court and represent their legacy.
What would you point to and say, these things along my path when I was a youngster, they're the things that most helped shape who I become and what I would chase?
The way that I was raised, you know, my parents instilling certain things into me that carried over into basketball, you know, working hard, being humble. I've had a lot of success in my career, but, you know, continuing to want to reach new heights and just enjoying the moment. I think that sometimes we get caught up in all the other things that are going on and still having fun in what I'm doing.
What were some of the things that you had to endure along the path that made it most challenging?
Just the adversity. You know, you can never expect what's to come, that type of thing. I'm coming off a ruptured Achilles, so my first game back was on Monday, USA versus UConn. And it's just like getting through that, being resilient and realizing that you can't understand why everything happens.
That's an awful injury. That's an injury that's hard to rehab from, too. That had to be terrible, right? All of it.
Yeah. I mean, from start to finish, it was a pain in the ass. When I did it when I was playing overseas, and it, you know, I wasn't prepared for it. I wasn't prepared for what was to come. And like you said, you know, it's just a hard thing to rehab. The rehab is super tedious, and in the beginning, you can't do much. You know, you can't walk on it, obviously. I couldn't walk for, like, 12 weeks. And then there was just a lot of boxes that needed to be checked in order to kind of move to the next round of rehab.
Do you have to play overseas, and forgive my ignorance on this, do you have to play overseas because the United States isn't good enough at supporting what you do here to put a value on it that's lucrative?
The WNBA, and now we have a new CBA where the salaries are going to be a little bit better, but we have a cap, and it makes it tough to compete with overseas where, you know, you can make a lot of money in a 7-8 month period, and sometimes we have to make decisions that are for our best interest financially. I mean, it's the same with you. If you get offered a ton of money, you're not going to say no unless, like, it really doesn't work out with what you're doing.
But why do the other countries value more what you do than we do?
I wouldn't say they value it more. I think that they don't have to have a cap, you know? They don't have a structure where it's like we can only use this much money for our team. They can use as much money as they want because they want to win. And they're trying to, you know, make sure that their team and their city is being represented really well.
How much culture shock have you had in any of the travel like that that you've had to do or the choices that you've had to make to take you outside of America?
I've had some. I mean, basketball has really taken me to a lot of different places, and it's been an experience for sure. My first 2 years that I played overseas, I was in Shanghai, China. And Shanghai is obviously a beautiful city, but China is hard to compare to the United States, especially when you come over there as a foreigner and you don't speak the language. So I would think that was like one of my biggest culture shocks, because when you play in China, you can only have one American. So it was me and 11 other Chinese players. And it made things interesting when you're trying to communicate.
Well, you got to tell me all of these stories, though, because it's not just that. Were you, I mean, you're vastly more amazing than anyone you step on a court with. But when it's you and 11 Chinese women, when you're the powerhouse, how lopsided was that team?
So every team gets to have one foreigner. But, you know, you're expected to do a lot because you come over there because you're one of the best. And you're expected to play at a high level for the entire game. And, you know, my 2 years in China were good, so I'm not going to say anything about them in that way. But it's tough on your body. It's not the same as, like, WNBA or when I was in college. It's because we had more resources to kind of help with your recovery and managing things and that type of thing.
You needed just some very basic things in order to stay healthy, to care for your body the way any great athlete, professional athlete would care for their body, and some of that was lacking?
Yeah, I mean, it's just a different world. You know, we have a lot of resources in the United States, and overseas they don't always have the same amount of resources.
I would imagine, Brianna, though, that it had to be pretty lonely. If you're the, like, yeah, not being able to talk to anybody, sculpting your craft, being great at what you do, and being over there because the money's good, like, that's not how it works in the United States for men who are as good at what they do as you are.
Right. Yeah, it was lonely for sure. I mean, especially so in China, you don't get to go home for the holidays. So I was over there for Christmas, Thanksgiving, and that type of thing. And that's when it's the hardest, because it's like you're not with your family and you're in China by yourself.
What difficulty did you have getting around? Because I couldn't get around Japan without a tour guide. I had no chance of doing that. Did you have some difficulty with that? Or did you have some? Did you have a translator?
So I had a translator. So he made life easier. By the time it was my second year, I kind of had a better understanding of what was going on and how to get around. But it's hard. You know, the language is really difficult. And obviously the symbols and the alphabet is completely different.
What was your motivation when you decided that you were going to do an essay in the Players Tribune and that you were going to show show people all of your vulnerability? What made you decide to do that?
I think the biggest thing for me was it was three falls ago, and the Me Too movement was just coming about. And, you know, I had this story that I wanted to share with people, and I didn't know when was the appropriate time to do it. And then when that movement came about, I was ready. And I was ready as I could have ever been. You know, I was still very nervous and didn't like to make myself feel vulnerable in that way. But I wanted to be able to, you know, show people that, yeah, I've done a lot of good things, but other things have happened to me too. And I'm still here and I'm still okay, and hopefully help people in that way.
When you say you wanted to share that and were looking for the right time to share it, it's self-evident in the article, but for those who haven't read it, can you explain why you wanted to share that?
I mean, I wanted to share it because it was time. And I was overseas in China when I was doing the article and when I posted it, and writing about my story on being a victim of sexual abuse. It was an appropriate time in our lives. And you know, with everything that was happening in society and in the world and the Me Too movement, I, you know, was kind of encouraged by the other victims who were speaking up and was ready.
You were inspired that you didn't have to be alone with that anymore, correct? And not only did you not want to be alone with that anymore, you were going to share it with everybody because you didn't want to be alone with it.
Yeah, I mean, the people that were close to me were aware of what I'd went through, but it was just something that, like, I wanted to show my whole true self to the world. And, you know, it wasn't something that I was hiding. It just wasn't something that I hadn't said. And I was ready to kind of make it known to everyone.
I'm curious because these things are so damaging, Brianna. They end up shaping you in ways known and unknown. When you've gone to the depths of examining the way that has altered you and what it is that you had to do to overcome that, what do you come away with? I know it's a broad question and it encompasses a lot, but this has to have something to do with shaping your worldview.
Yeah, no, I think it's definitely something that shaped me. And, you know, it happened to me when I was younger. And at that time, I probably didn't even realize it, but just having a different appreciation for what's going on, how important life is, and, you know, like, certain things that we think are big deals really aren't that important in the grand scheme of life. And, you know, looking back on it, I'm very happy and proud of myself that I did that. And it was like, you know, a weight lifted off of my shoulders that I didn't even know I had. You know, the people that were closest to me knew what I had been through in my life, like I said before, but being genuine, and I think, you know, a lot of people struggle with being genuine in their own lives, helped me a lot.
How did being a survivor of sexual abuse affect your relationships with people, all kinds of people? Where did it make you distrusting? Where did it make you someone who didn't want things in her life that were too vulnerable or too intimate?
It made me someone that was hard to trust people, which, I mean, makes sense, but I didn't want to kind of explain my whole life or share anything in my life that was personal to me unless I really trusted that person. And it just kind of put into perspective, like, I've been through worse before, you know, and having that kind of mindset going forward.
Oh, what do you mean? Like going through and rehabbing your Achilles? You've been through worse before and there is nothing worse. That's the worst I've been through. So I can overcome anything.
Yeah, exactly.
you can't be great at sports without that, can you? Like, you can't, the excellence, the loneliness that there is in greatness, not just in being in Shanghai when you're one of the best in the world, but your craft, to dedicate yourself to it with that kind of zeal, it can't be done unless you're very good at overcoming adversity. So you're sitting here saying that in some ways that shaped you the most as a professional, because you can overcome things and be great because you've known no greater competition than the hurt of that.
Right, exactly. I mean, if I look back and look at all the things that I've gone through in my life, like, I can do anything I want because, you know, what's worse than those things that I've gone through, and having the strength to get through that and be better.
And so, yeah, wow. So you're looking at something that was universally considered a negative and looking at it and say, that made me stronger. It made me someone who was able to go get the stuff that I wanted from life.
No, absolutely. It made me a stronger person, and it's something that I'm not ashamed about.
Is there anything else that you're thinking of there when you're thinking specifically of hardship? Because you're saying the Achilles heel and obviously sexual abuse, those are two very different things. What other adversities are you looking at saying that is integral to shaping my greatness?
At this time, those are the biggest things that stick out. And, you know, my life is my life, and what I've gone through is what shaped me to where I am and the outlook that I have. And, you know, some things you go through aren't the greatest, but, you know, everybody has their thing. And, you know, turning some bad things into good things is what I'm trying to do.
Thank you, Brianna. We appreciate your time. Thank you for giving us so much of it.
Awesome. Thank you.
Our thanks to Brianna Stewart. You will be rooting for her when the U.S. is playing in the Olympics and we put on the patriotism and the flags and we care for a moment about women's basketball, maybe the way that we have cared about women's soccer in a way that has been transcendent. Before we get to Sarah Spain and more elaboration, because she's done a lot of reporting over the years, she's super informed on some of this stuff, let's get to this week's sponsor on South Beach Sessions, the folks that are keeping this stuff free.
Dan, and it's brought to you by our friends at ZipRecruiter, who have been with us since day one. Hiring is challenging, but there is one place where you can go where hiring is simple, fast, and smart, and growing businesses connect to qualified candidates. Cafe El Toro COO Dylan Miskowitz experienced how challenging hiring can be after unsuccessfully searching for a director of coffee for his organic coffee company. But then he switched to ZipRecruiter and saw an immediate difference. And you can too by signing up for free at ZipRecruiter.com/beach. ZipRecruiter doesn't depend on candidates finding you, it finds them for you. And its technology identifies people with the right experience and invites them to apply to your job, so you get qualified candidates faster. In fact, after posting his job to ZipRecruiter, Dylan said he was amazed by how quickly great candidates were applying and found his new director of coffee in just a few days. With results like that, it's no wonder 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. See why ZipRecruiter is effective for businesses of all sizes. Try ZipRecruiter for free at our web address, ZipRecruiter.com/beach. That's ZipRecruiter.com/BEACH.
Thanks to ZipRecruiter for supporting the things that we do around here. Please support the people who support us. Sarah Spain is one of those people. That's what she said is her podcast. It's an excellent, easy listen. She is super informed. So let's talk to her about women's sports, women's basketball, and the struggles and the reasons for those struggles. So I probably should have said all this while talking to Brianna Stewart about how she was a 4-time champion at UConn and then a rookie of the year, drafted number 1 overall, MVP of the WNBA, finals MVP of the WNBA. But I want to understand a little better why it is that has such a hard time making money in this country. Sarah Spain, the That's What She Said podcast, you should check it out. A lot of good stuff she's doing over there. Help me understand it, Sarah, because women have made a lot of progress. The WNBA has been vigorously supported by the NBA, and yet here I am talking to Brianna about the fact that she's got to work in China under not great conditions with the training staff, even though she's at the very top of her game. How does that happen?
Well, it's something that people who support women's sports and specifically basketball have been trying to figure out for a while. And part of it is things that I think we do understand. There is an allegiance to collegiate sports because of connections to your alma mater, because of pride in the conferences that you attended. There's this support around women's college basketball. It's something that Brianna actually mentioned in her ESPYs speech 1 year, is how do we translate the excitement and enthusiasm that she felt at UConn, this massive program that had achieved this incredible status and had great support, and bring that to the WNBA. Now, the WNBA, despite being 25 years old, is still relatively new. So there isn't that attached nostalgia and history. People don't have memories necessarily of growing up with their parents attending WNBA games. So you have to create that and actively seek it out in ways that you maybe don't with something like, you know, going to a Cubs game that you have always gone to and that has this cachet around it in the public profile. So that's a couple things. And then I think the CBA for the WNBA has been problematic up until now. It's the new CBA appears to be a massive sea change in terms of percentage of revenue for the players and in terms of the intent to invest. One of the things that people want to talk about with the WNBA is how often the NBA and Adam Silver and league officials want to point out how much money it loses, which is not something that any other company that is trying to succeed and make money does. They don't publicly tell you about their failures. They instead understand that the initial investment needs to be great enough to drive interest, to make a product that is good, and to get people invested in it so that on the other end, you make money. You talk about Netflix on your show a lot, right? How much money Netflix loses because the end goal is much bigger than succeeding in the now. And the WNBA thus far has not been willing to truly invest the way that a startup would in the product with a belief that it will eventually pay off. And if you're half in, half out, I think you end up with what they've had so far, where they have these moments of great success and people are interested and there's drive there. And then this pulling back and this sort of like never being able to get that next big step. I think that requires an investment that up till now they have not shown.
Can it be said though that the NBA has been more supportive of this than just about any male enterprise? And so when you combine that with the fact that Brianna is able to get a Nike contract, what do you say to the person who says, hey, look, this is huge progress. The WNBA is way out in front of everybody else.
Well, I guess I would say, what's the end goal? To be able to hold it up as something that the NBA is doing as a sort of charitable act? To hold it up as this is the best we've seen yet? Or to say, if we did more, and if this was about creating a profitable business based on the way that anyone else would try to create one, what would we see? Now, I'm not trying to compare the two because there's obviously a whole bunch of context there, but look at the amount of money that was sunk into the AAF and it couldn't last a season, right? The amount of money we're willing to put into yet another football league when we have, you know, tried this a bunch of times and what tiny percentage the NBA's investment in the WNBA is when compared to some concept like that. Now, I'm not saying do that because it didn't work. I'm not saying throw a whole bunch of money without a plan. But I think over the course of 25 years, they've been able to start to understand what works and what doesn't and what it requires to get people invested in something like this. Now, it's not just on the WNBA. Media matters, right? The investment from media and people to decide that this is something worth covering and to be cool, quote unquote, and for people to want to jump on board. And I think the WNBA in some ways is still recovering from the initial reaction from some of the biggest voices, guys like Bill Simmons and people who made a joke out of it and who decided from day one that it was something that they would mock rather than at the very least ignore. They decided to make a joke out of it and not respect the athletes and the people playing. And that's, I think, partly also the way basketball works. I think, Dan, like a lot of dudes think if they just got out there, they'd be able to beat these gals, and if they watched footage of themselves at their local Y playing basketball, they would realize that it doesn't look anything like what they're watching. But because basketball is accessible, you can go grab a ball and go out and find a hoop and play it yourself. It feels a little different maybe than watching women figure skaters or even tennis, where you can tell the power that they play with. And I think women's tennis, women's soccer, women's hockey, even at times, some of the acceptance there comes from not having the same stereotypes and in some ways racist and homophobic ideas about what that sport means for women getting in the way of enjoying it.
Do they have enough paying customers to reward a substantive investment? Because generally speaking, if there's money to be found somewhere, people will pour money into finding that money.
That's tough to say, Dan, because part of the money invested is to drive interest and drive awareness so that you know where the games are and when they're being played and why you should want to go watch them. And what's the story of this player and why you should want to go watch her play? If you look at, for instance, some of the problems for either women's soccer or hockey, there is investment. And then people go to the website and say, I want to buy a jersey for X or Y, and they can't even get it. Right. And what we understand about sports is it's not just showing up at a stadium, but it's, can I get the gear and wear it around proudly? And can other people watch me walking around wearing my Red Stars gear or my Chicago Sky gear and then say, this is a tangible thing that I can own to represent my fandom? And then do other people see that and say, that's something cool that I should also look into or watch? Right. It's awareness of the brand, which is as much for these burgeoning new leagues as anything else, especially somewhere like Chicago, for instance, where you've got every team imaginable, two baseball teams, a football team, a hockey team. You know, you've got everything to go see. Why would you choose that, especially if you're not aware of it in this crowded marketplace? So are the fans there? There are a lot of fans, especially in certain pockets. Certain teams do a great job of attendance-wise selling out. But would there be more fans if they wanted to go because they knew the stories and the stakes and they had the gear and they knew based on media coverage that it was something to care about? You know, you look at like the XFL and the amount of coverage that's been given to it before it's even in existence, people getting on board, waiting in line for merchandise. There's no connection there to that. It's the idea of something that they want to be a part of. And ESPN's done a great job of constantly pushing it as something they want to be a part of. That should happen with the WNBA in ways that I don't know that it does yet.
Our U.S. women's soccer team is an inspiration to young girls. There's an emotional attachment to a lot of things that that team represents. Why is the U.S. women's basketball team, which is, right, every bit as dominant, why is the connection not quite the same?
Even more dominant. I mean, they're like unbelievable. The women's Olympic basketball team is in a league of their own. And that might be part of it, right? There might be this idea that they're so good that it's a given that they're going to win, which isn't really fair. I think they've won 8 out of 10 Olympics that they've been in. I think, again, some of it comes back to, and Megan Rapinoe has spoken about this, how the majority of the women's soccer team is socially palatable. They are white, girl next door, physically sort of, you know, stereotypically appealing and attractive, as compared to basketball, where, it's a lot of women of color. It's a lot of out, or at least appearing to be out, LGBTQ. It's physical dominance. It's a sport that requires strength and power and aggression in a way that soccer doesn't. And it's not to say that soccer isn't physical. I mean, those women play with broken noses and anything else. But the actual sport itself of basketball is watching taller, bigger, blacker women compete against each other. And still working on that in the U.S. in terms of acceptance. I mean, look at Serena Williams in the sport of tennis, which otherwise is, you know, and Serena is obviously incredibly popular. But the amount that she's had to go through to be accepted in a world that was used to girl next door in a white dress.
Well, explain how much the WNBA and women's basketball has been hurt by the sexuality stuff, the idea that there are a lot of lesbians out there, that Brittany Griner gets into a controversy that you're never going to see in men's sports where she's having a relationship with one of her teammates, or I'm not sure whether it was a teammate actually or someone on the other, one of the other teams, but regardless, it was a messy relationship thing. How much has it been harmed or hurt or held back by that?
Well, what's interesting is when they first started the league, one of their missteps was sort of trying to sexualize the players. It was about the hair and the makeup and the fashion they had. And you go back and look at some of the photos and it's classic, like hilarious to see the women that we now know better and see in their preferred attire and approach to everything, you know, draped across a car or wear like Diana Taurasi in a crop top, like a pink crop top, things that just don't feel right for the people that we know that they are now. But that was how they tried to market it at the beginning, because they thought in order to be palatable, they needed to be sexualized.
Is that because men were doing the marketing? Is that because...
I don't know, actually. I don't know if it was just men or if they didn't know what to, you know, they didn't know how to sell it, but they thought, probably rightly so, that the usual acceptance of women in sports is, you know, can we watch them play sports but also be attracted to them? So that's how it started. And it just, first of all, felt very awkward and not authentic to the people, to most of the people that were in those ads. And, you know, it's all rooted in homophobia, right? If you're too mannish or if you are not a traditionally appealing woman, we're not going to want to watch you, even if you're great at what you do. But so much of that has changed, and they're actually really embracing sort of androgyny in the WNBA. And one of the things they did this year that was really, I think, useful was they would have these videos of all the players coming into games, you know, sort of WNBA fits, and show their drip, if you will. I feel very old saying both those things, but that's what they would say, showing their fashion and their choices, and included a lot of androgyny and sort of masculine fashion, and the swag that they came with felt more authentic to them. And they even have events now that are LGBTQ nights, and they're very aware and okay with that being part of a massive part of their fan base. Instead of fighting it and trying to say, you know, look at these beautiful women who also play basketball, they're just leaning in now to who the people that make up their league are, and hoping that we're entering a better time for androgyny. And it's actually very fashionable right now to be sort of in that kind of fashionable masculine presentation for even women that aren't LGBTQ. So I think they're just kind of letting them be themselves more and hoping that that's okay today in ways that it wasn't even 25 years ago.
Is there a way to quantify whether or not, 2019 WNBA Most Valuable Player Elena Deladon, who is, you know, classically pretty, classically attractive, how does that help when you need the male customer, right? You need, in order for sports to be a profitable business, you kind of need the male paying customer, don't you?
In order for it to be big, yeah. I mean, you could have a whole mess of women that attend these games, but in order for it to be big, it'd be easier and better for it to be families and couples and whole groups of people that want to watch. And we know that a lot of men are more willing to watch literally whatever sport they turn on. I mean, Elena's an interesting one because when she entered the league, I actually, you know, was there when she was drafted. I did interviews with her welcoming her to Chicago. And early on, there was, it wasn't that she denied her sexuality, but she wasn't open about it. So if I would talk to her and joke with her about, you know, Chicago's got a lot of tall guys, she would kind of joke along. And it wasn't until several years in that she came out publicly, and she's now married to her wife and is open about it and is much more herself and has much more of a personality because she's now herself and is more into activism and issues outside of just basketball. She is beautiful, though. Sue Bird is openly gay and is beautiful. And I don't know, Dan. I mean, it's hard because would women watch men's sports if they were all completely beat? I don't know. It's hard to say. You know, we can't, you know, have a separate universe where we present an entire team of disgusting men and see if everyone's as into it as we are. I don't think it should be necessary for men to want to enjoy sports for them to be attracted to the people playing it, because that doesn't happen on the men's side, presumably, for a lot of dudes. But I imagine that it certainly doesn't hurt when you've got, you know, some of the women that are playing that are high profile being physically attractive as well as incredibly talented.
What needs to happen for a Brianna to become Megan Rapinoe, say, for to transcend and make her way into cultural icon?
Man, I mean, it's interesting because Rapinoe was popular for a long time, but there was this like just kind of moment, this zeitgeist where it combined all the conversations around equal pay, this newer acceptance of LGBTQ, the badass haircut, the cool high profile relationship with another female superstar, her incredible play. I mean, this is someone who at one point wasn't sure if she was going to make the roster coming off an injury and was, you know, publicly saying she wouldn't go to the White House. Donald Trump said, win something first before you even talk. And then she goes out and just destroys not only MVP of the World Cup, but Ballon d'Or, and is doing things that I don't think she even could have anticipated for herself in her wildest dreams heading into that tournament, as great as she was. You combine all of that with a lot of people in the country being, you know, disenchanted with the current administration and their statements on a variety of social issues. So she becomes represented for something beyond sport. My friend Kelly, that I grew up with here in Chicago, doesn't like any sports. She saw Megan Rapinoe do an interview. I don't even know how she happened upon it, because she certainly was not on ESPN. Decided to go to a Women's World Cup watch party in a park here in Chicago. Brought a book with her in case she was bored. Loved it. Went to another game, went to a Red Stars game with me, flew herself to the Rose Bowl to see the women's national team. Like, Megan Rapinoe was an entry point for her into sports, not just women's soccer, but she had no interest in any sports other than that. And so I think she represented so much more. So Brianna, I don't know how you transcend being just great at what you do. And on the men's side, you don't really have to, right? Like, think about someone, like, I always think about Michael Thomas, like, I don't know anything about Michael Thomas. Do you know anything about Michael Thomas?
Well, that Stugatz thinks he looks like he's very good at sex.
Okay, that's all we know, right? I'm not sure about that. I'll have to get back to you on that one. Okay. But, I mean, probably, based
just
on
looks
his athleticism.
Just, yeah,
athleticism
just looks
alone.
Like it. Just looks
probably.
At the V,
yeah.
The sexy V,
exactly.
The chiseled
yeah.
chin.
Yeah, he's got nice, he's kind of smizing. He's got the blue steel. But yeah, I don't know anything about him. And he's fantastic, and he makes tons of money, and he gets to be successful, and he doesn't have to have any personality or do any work. On the women's side, you have to be the best at what you do, and then also be able to. Megan Rapinoe gave a drunken speech in the middle of their ticker tape parade that was more articulate and intelligent and thoughtful and powerful than most people could spend hours writing down and then having to read off a paper. And she did it, you know, extemporaneously off the top of her head. Like, Hillary Knight has to not only be an amazing hockey player, but have 18,000 endorsements that she's constantly posting about, be likable, be attractive, be fun, do the body issue. Like, they have to be so much more than just good at their sport. They have to be the representatives for it. And if they have the tiniest slip up, that will get covered five times as much as most of what they do, because that's what we're interested in, is the salacious gossip. Or maybe when they're at the very, very, very top of what they do and the middle stuff doesn't get anything. And so I don't know what Brianna would have to do except to say that can some perfect cultural zeitgeist hit at the exact moment that she's also just destroying everyone and everything. Like, I think what's interesting, I was just talking to someone about this. Sabrina Ionescu is able to get the credit and the conversation around her that she has now because of what UConn and Brianna already did, right? Sabrina Ionescu is insanely good, and she's really fun to watch. And, you know, we attach to things like triple-doubles. And when you say someone's done this more than even men have, suddenly people are like, oh, she must be good then because she's better than a guy. And with Brianna, she's the only person that's ever been, you know, four-time player of the tournament. She was, you know, part of this UConn team that was so dominant. And predictably, UConn's dominance was, quote unquote, bad for the game because they won by too much. And now that they're not winning as much, it's, quote unquote, bad for the game that we don't have a dominant team to care about and a dynasty to hate on. If you're not into women's basketball, you're probably going to come up with an excuse on either side of that as to why it's not that compelling. But because of UConn and the eyeballs that it drew and the conversation that it drew, even if it was simplistic bullshit conversations like, are they bad for the game? We at least were talking about them and realizing their greatness. And because of that, when Sabrina Ionescu shows up playing for the Ducks and is doing what she does, we can have a conversation about her play and how great she is, because we've already at least opened the door ajar to this is something we have a general idea and understanding of. So when she goes in to stores and hands them the worst loss they've ever had in their building there, we get what that means, right? And so, you know, sometimes it's about being, you know, the right person in the right time too, because I would argue Brianna maybe would have gotten even more of the Sabrina treatment had she come in the footsteps of herself.
That's What She Said is her podcast. You should check it out. And not just because she can talk basketball. She does pop culture stuff. A lot of good stuff to be found on That's What She Said. She's an expert in this particular realm because she battled Sean Bradley's sister poorly.
That's right.
For rebounds.
That's right. Mm-hmm.
And she just kept throwing it against the backboard, and you just kept jumping up and doing nothing. She crushed you on the offensive
basically,
board.
Yeah, she – listen, I don't want to slander the good name of his sister, and I don't know her name, so I can't specifically slander it. But I just remember in one AAU tournament that she was so tall that she could just miss it, get the rebound, miss it, get the rebound, and on the third or fourth shot, make it. It was very frustrating.
You did nothing about it. And then you chose, like many of us, a career in journalism. Thank you, Sarah, for being on with us.
Thanks, Dan.
Thanks to Brianna Stewart and Sarah Spain for spending that time with us. We ask you to support the people who support us. And part of making everything around here a menu of content for you is that everyone gets their little universe. And Mystery Crate is one of the places where you will find in the Lebatard and Friends Network something that feels the most like the radio show that has lured you here. So take it away.
Yo, Craters! What up? What up? What up? What up? What up? What up?
Hey, everybody.
Oh, we got such a great episode coming for you this week.
Yeah.
A nightlife icon here in the town of Miami talks to Billy Gill. They're diametrically opposed in, like, just vibe.
Right.
But it's going to be fun. Should we give it away who it is?
Nah, let's not do that.
Dan's vibe
has just very, I'm very serious. This is very important what we're talking about. That's not us at the Mystery
No.
Train. We're having
no.
fun.
We're clowns.
We're doing wacky stuff.
We got no credibility.
Yeah.
So subscribe, rate, review, because it's all the fun parts of the local hour that you undoubtedly already subscribe, listen to. So it's all of that fun, but we go out there. We do different things. Yep. We were on Tony Khan's yacht, for Christ's sakes.
Yachting it.
We take hacks, people. So go ahead and support Mystery Crate. It's worth your time.
Give me a tour with your ears.
Mm-hmm. With Dan's friend, Al.
Yeah. Al.